What we really need here is a network utility. People get their highway bill every month like they get their electric bill and their water bill and their cell phone bill. They're paying for what they use and only what they use.
Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with Reason. We're talking with Bob Poole. He's the Searle Freedom Trust Fellow and Director of Transportation Policy at Reason Foundation. And we're talking about Donald Trump's transportation policies, or likely transportation policies, and whether or not they're good for libertarians, or from a libertarian perspective. Bob, thanks for talking to us.
Glad to be here, Nick.
So what is the essence of Trump's transportation policy? Has he really kind of articulated a plan, and where do you think he's heading?
What we know so far is he talked a lot about crumbling infrastructure and need to make America's infrastructure great again.
Right.
So this suggests a big new emphasis in some kind of a federal program.
And is that accurate? Is our infrastructure crumbling,
big exaggeration.
Yeah.
I mean, we do reports on this at Reason Foundation, and if you look at, for example, structurally deficient bridges, that has trended downward sharply over the last two decades. There's still quite a few, hundreds of them, actually a few thousand of them out there. But it's gotten much less bad.
But there's no question
there's
that
no question
we could
things,
use new roads,
yes,
more roads.
Yes. Well, the interstate highway system, the first ones built are past their 50-year service life, and few of them have actually been replaced with fresh pavement and new bridges. Mm. There's $1 trillion worth just alone over the next 20 or 30 years in replacement.
Hillary at one point talked about creating something like a $500 billion infrastructure bank, and then Trump said, I'm going to double that.
Well, there's actually two Trump numbers that are out there. One is $550 billion that's repeatedly seen in news articles. Mm-hmm. The other is $1 trillion, which is the plan developed by Wilbur Ross, an investment banker, and Peter Navarro, who's an economist at UC San Diego. And that's a 10-page document that is a public-private partnership.
Is that $550 billion or the $1 trillion, is that all coming out of taxpayer money?
The $550 billion, we don't really have a clue.
Right.
That has been implied that that's out of some kind of tax reform and possibly repatriation of overseas profits. That would be a one-time catch-up sort of big investment thing. But the $1 trillion plan from Wilbur Ross and Peter Navarro is a P3, public-private partnership plan, that the only federal involvement in that, other than Congress authorizing it, would be a tax credit for the equity investors. But these would be like the P3 projects that we're seeing in Virginia and Texas and Florida, typically financed about 25% by equity, like a down payment on a house, and 75% by debt. Revenue bonds, typically.
And when you say a revenue bond, explain how that's different than the state just borrowing.
Right. The
money.
Revenue bond has to be backed by a user fee revenue stream. So this would be tolls, water bills, electricity transmission fees, whatever, something like that. So, I mean, this plan is bigger than many people expected if it goes forward, but it's also more narrowly constrained because you'd have to have your customer user fees in places like most of the interstates where we don't have them today. So that becomes a big political question mark.
And would
there be a will to do that?
Would that get rid of kind of gas taxes or taxes that traditionally are supposed to be earmarked for?
No, it wouldn't get rid of it because that would be more radical than anybody in Congress would be prepared to do or the state DOTs. But it would be a way, without increasing the federal gas taxes, a way to have a big increase in infrastructure investment based on an increase in user fee revenues, direct user fee.
So talk a little bit about the massive amount of capital that is out there all over the globe to put into these giant infrastructure programs at a point where there isn't a state in the country, and certainly not the federal government, has a lot of money to blow on this
Right,
stuff.
Right. Well, the growth globally for the last 15 years is in the growth of infrastructure investment funds. Some of them run by investment banks. Some of them run by sovereign wealth funds. Mm-hmm. Some of them run by private equity firms that do corporate takeovers and so forth. They've amassed big portfolios of money, and they're looking globally, worldwide, at airports, electric transmission lines, water and wastewater systems, toll roads, and so forth, as places to invest equity and to finance these public-private partnerships, either outright purchases and ownership or long-term lease concessions, public-private partnerships that may be 50-year duration, that are financed by the equity down payment and revenue bonds that they would issue.
Is there a political understanding or a sense of crisis that, we really do need to be doing something about infrastructure?
Yeah,
is there a political will to say, we're going to bring in outside investors and shift? This is kind of like the shift from free TV to cable.
Right, right.
It's
I mean, this is a big question mark, Nick. We don't know. The House T&I Committee, on a bipartisan basis about 2 years ago, this was another Chairman Schuster initiative, did a six-month project. They had a task force of some of their members on public-private partnerships and the role they could play in transportation infrastructure. And it was a pretty good report. Now, the question is, did the members who signed on to that from both parties really understand what they were endorsing? And would they be prepared to have the federal government bless and encourage a much larger scale use of those mechanisms?
Talk about Obama's transportation policy as it kind of contrasts with
what
Trump seems
to be going to. It's definitely a big contrast. I mean, the first one was he was going to do an Eisenhower analog of the interstate highways with a nationwide high-speed rail dream. Well, that was completely foolish and has basically got nowhere. The only part standing is the ridiculous California boondoggle that is now, with the Republican takeover, is not going to get any more federal money, and they can't find any other real state money, and no private sector companies are willing to invest in it. So that one, that's dead. Obama's repeated, almost every year of his 8 years, he put in a proposed transportation bill that would have a big increase in spending without an increase in revenue sources, and would convert the Highway Trust Fund, which has a small piece, 20% for transit, into a transportation trust fund so that every mode, Amtrak could tap into it, boondoggle projects on waterways, maritime highways could tap into it, and so on and so forth. That never got a hearing even in Congress. But he tried it again and again and again. So that's now dead and buried.
Who are some of the people, and I know you've been talking to people that Trump is, again, early in the transition process and whatnot, but is talking to, and do they give you hope, or do they give you a little, kind of night sweats?
I'm encouraged by what I see. First of all, the person heading the team in the transition for the US DOT is Shirley Wybarra, my former Reason colleague, who was the Secretary of Transportation in Virginia, where she came up with and got implemented the Public-Private Transportation Act, the blueprint for P3 projects in Virginia, which has become a model for other states to follow. Shirley was also part of a business roundtable task force on Air Traffic Control Corporation, of pulling that out of FAA and setting it up as a self-funded corporation.
What would be the main benefit of taking air traffic control away from a government agency to a corporate, where the airlines themselves are running it?
Be a bunch of benefits. As a bureaucracy that's dependent on annual appropriations based on aviation user tax revenue, this money every year has to be appropriated by Congress, and Congress loves to micromanage that. If you're doing multi-billion-dollar capital modernization and you have no idea from 1 year to the next what they're going to appropriate, what they're going to veto, this plays havoc with sensible planning.
And that's why our air traffic control system really
lags behind Canada, Britain, Australia, New Zealand, and a number of other countries that have created air traffic corporations and got it out of the political. They've depoliticized it.
Beyond safety measures, it also it increases the number of planes that can fly.
It maximizes the use of, right now technology is what constrains how many planes can be in a given amount of airspace. More accurate, real-time information means you can make more intensive use of the airspace. So this is something that seems very consistent with what we're seeing about user fee financing and so forth. I hope this becomes a priority for the Trump administration, but a lot will depend on who becomes Secretary of Transportation.
Final question. Talk a little bit about user fees, because I'm hearing my liberal and progressive friends saying, now the corporations are going to own the roads. And about poor people? How do the poor get around if they're living in a world where every time they hit the road or go, that they're paying out?
Well, they're paying out now every time they put gas in their car. And the question is, can we come up with a better system that's actually more transparent and more accountable to the users? And I've written a book that's now, we hope, nearing to a publisher contract on a model for 21st century highways that says, look, what we really need here is a network utility that people get their highway bill every month like they get their electric bill and their water bill and their cell phone bill, and they know exactly they're paying for what they use and only what they use. They're not subsidizing all kinds of other projects that they'd never see or never use.
I would assume for people who can't afford or who low-income people, you can help them with a cash grant that allows, the same way we do. We don't say because some people can't afford food, we
nationalize the food stamps. Yeah. And what we should have been doing all along, instead of subsidizing transit agencies, is giving the poor transit vouchers and allowing them to spend them. And the transit system could then price everybody else at what it really costs to pay for the capital and as well as the operating costs of the system.
I will leave, Bob, this. It's always good to talk to you. And transportation is fascinating. When you were growing up, what did you hope for as a mode of transportation when you're the age you are now? Was it, you know, was it a personal backpack, a hovercraft?
Well, my uncle actually was in the Army Transportation Research Command, and he always sending me things about hovercrafts and jetpacks. They tried all that stuff, and it didn't really pan out. But actually, I grew up in an Eastern Airlines household, and so we flew everywhere on company passes. So what I really wanted was, I didn't know it at the time, but what I wanted was airline deregulation, because Eastern, when I was a kid, applied for the route from Miami, where I grew up, to Los Angeles, and didn't get it. And so that when Disneyland opened, we couldn't go because we had no way my parents could afford to take the whole family on commercial flights at commercial prices that were very high in those days. So my very first published article in Reason magazine in 1969 was advocating airline deregulation, inspired by that childhood.
And now I trust that you've gone to, have you been to Disneyland?
I've been to Disneyland and Disney World in Florida, both multiple occasions.
All right, well, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
For Reason, I'm Nick Gillespie.